This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Good afternoon. I'm Chris Nolte. It's Thursday, which means it's Reporters Roundtable Thursday, where we get reporters from the local media to join us to talk about the stories that they have filed in print and online. We have on the program today in the studio Bill Dolan with the Times of Northwest Indiana to talk about the Bunsich trial that he was sitting in on. We'll also as well have up from the Times as well, we'll have Joseph Pete with a business report on the stories that he has covered for the business section of the newspaper and website. And we'll also as well have John Gard from the LaPorte Herald Argus and Michigan City News Dispatch to talk about the LaPorte County stories that he's covered recently as well, too. On this Reporters Roundtable Thursday, let's talk first with Bill Dolan, who covers, among other things, the court stories that happened involving county government and county government in general, of course, for the Times of Northwest Indiana. And Bill's in the studio with us today. Thank you for taking time to visit with us, and as well as fill us in on the tales of probably one of the trials, maybe not necessarily of all times, but certainly of recent years anyway. When it comes to public corruption, we're talking about the recent trial involving former Lake County Sheriff now, John Bunsich.
Good afternoon. Thank you for having me. Yeah, we don't have Lake County Sheriffs convicted every day, so it's a bit of history.
Well, the last one was Rudy Bartolome, and that was quite a while ago.
And actually, he pled guilty. He didn't even go to trial. Uh-huh. So this was quite a show.
When people read the stories that are online and in print, of course, about a trial, and I figure we'll just kind of take it step by step through the process. It started out, of course, once the announcement of the trial being held and all the pretrial hoopla from the attorneys involved, including the U.S. Attorney's Office. And then finally, we get to the trial itself. It started out with the jury selection. What was it like to be in the courtroom in Hammond? Of course, all this time, from the very beginning, so to speak, at least when the trial began, and having a chance to witness what was said and what you heard in the courtroom.
Well, it's a funny thing. We weren't in the courtroom when they picked the jury, which was August the 7th, 3 weeks ago now, maybe four. That's always done without any of the public present, because they had called probably 50 people. There was some concern that they would have trouble finding somebody who hadn't read previous news coverage of the events surrounding Sheriff Bunsich. But in fact, they got a jury selected within a couple hours in the morning, and we started testimony, to my surprise, early afternoon of August the 7th. And of course, it always starts with opening arguments with the government, in the person of Assistant U.S. Attorney Philip Benson, who is a veteran prosecutor, giving the case against Sheriff Bunsich. And of course, the charges are bribery, wire fraud, and honest services wire fraud. And in essence, he told the jury that they will not only hear testimony, they will see and hear recordings of the deals being made that surreptitiously recorded by the FBI and their undercover agent, a fellow by the name of Scott Jurgensen, who was owner of Samson Towing in Merrillville and a 20-year veteran of the Merrillville Police Department.
That was interesting as I was reading the stories and seeing how things kind of shaped up here during the presentation of the testimony about the fact that here we have this former police officer who, grantedly, goes into business for himself and decides that he wants to get involved and finding himself, certainly in this case here, on the other side of the law.
Well, he was the first witness for the government, and what he said in essence is that when he got into towing, he assumed that he could get contracts with not only the town of Merrillville, who he had worked for 20 years, but other local government police agencies. Police are always having need of tow trucks to remove accidents, crime scene vehicles, and what have you. But he couldn't get a contract, and he mentioned this to an FBI agent by the name of Nathan Holbrook. And when Holbrook asked him, why can't you get it, he says, well, I won't pay bribes. And in essence, Mr. Holbrook said, well, would you like to start paying those bribes on our behalf so we can investigate them? And after a couple of weeks of soul searching, he decided that he would. And the investigation began, I believe, around 2012, but it didn't work its way around to the sheriff's department until about 3 years ago. Mr. Jurgensen was very close to a fellow by the name of Timothy Downs, who was the number two in the sheriff's department. Jurgensen and Downs had worked together as police officers, and in fact, Jurgensen had coached Downs' children in sports. So when Downs came calling to Samson Towing and asking if he would buy some political fundraising tickets, the investigation of the sheriff's office began.
Mm-hmm. It sounds like, and it came out, of course, in your stories as well, too, about the fact that all this testimony talking about ways to make money, one way or the other, from different people. It's either, as you said, from Scott Jurgensen, who wanted to be able to make make money by getting a towing contract with the county and getting the business from the county officers on whatever it happened to be. And then you've got the case here involving the sheriff's department, where you've got these political fundraising tickets. And since you've covered other cases before, I know, Bill, that have brought up these issues of how politicians have found ways to creative ways, I suppose, to raise money for their campaigns to either be elected or to be reelected, as the case may be. It's probably interesting that this should happen, not surprising that this should come up.
Well, the sheriff, when he testified, said that it costs about $200,000 to run for sheriff, a tidy sum, and very few people have that money in their back pocket. So they obviously have to seek donations from the public, and of course, all elected officials do so. But of course, again, FBI agent Nathan Holbrook explained, it's perfectly legitimate to request donations. What you can't do is promise something in return for those donations. Mm-hmm. And that's what Sheriff Buntzich was accused of. He was accused of promising any of these tow truck drivers who donated to him more lucrative business to benefit them. And the government says that's a bribe, and that's what happened here.
And obviously, that's what came out in the testimony as well. To the sheriff's point, what did the defense team happen to say about all of this?
Well, they argued several things. One, that the sheriff was simply doing legitimate campaign fundraising. Number two, they argued that Timothy Downs, who had collected a lot of money on the sheriff's behalf, may have kept some of this money, and therefore that bribe money never reached the sheriff's desk. They also argued that, in essence, the FBI was trying to buy a crime by funneling money through Mr. Jurgensen to the sheriff, and in essence, entrapping the sheriff.
When this all came about, obviously, you have the one side, he says, sort of saying, that always comes up here. You've got the government arguing, against the sheriff, and you have the sheriff's attorneys arguing in favor of their client. When it finally came down to the closing arguments, was it pretty much more of the same, just a more summation of what the jury and anybody else, including yourself, sitting in the courtroom, heard?
This was where this trial differs from many I've covered, is the fact that there wasn't just he said, she said stuff. The government had several witnesses who accused the sheriff of wrongdoing, and the sheriff got on the witness stand and denied all of it. What we had here was video. And in fact, we were able to post the video after it was shown to the jury, to our readers, and they're quite available. You can see them for yourself on our website of Timothy Downs, the number two in the sheriff's department, after he agreed to cooperate with the government, walking $7,500 into the sheriff's department, plunking it down on his desk, and the sheriff picking it up and putting it in his desk drawer. Other video included Mr. Jurgensen handing money to the sheriff and the sheriff putting it in his back pocket. There were several videos like that, and there were audio tapes as well and conversations between the sheriff and Mr. Jurgensen and another co-defendant by the name of William Zarmack, who later pled guilty and cooperated with the government, about what kind of towing they could get in return for this money.
Now, once the jury heard all this, and they, of course, got instructions from Judge Moody to do what they're supposed to do, following the laws and the procedures in the federal courts, they went off to deliberate the case. How long did the deliberations take, as best as you can count the hours, I suppose, so to speak?
5 hours.
5 hours. So.
Over Thursday night and Friday morning, Thursday, August the 24th, Friday, August the 25th. The jury came back about 10 a.m. that Friday morning, and guilty on all counts. And, of course, a guilty conviction in the case of Sheriff John Buntzich meant his removal immediately from office. State law does not give any slack there. The minute the jury returns a guilty verdict, the defendant is no longer an elected official. Mm-hmm. So now we have to find a new sheriff.
And we'll get into that, too. We're going to take a brief break. We're talking with Bill Dolan with the Times of Northwest Indiana, focusing in here during our conversation about the recent trial of former sheriff in Lake County, John Buntzich. We'll be right back.
When you tune in to Lakeshore Public Radio, you hear a lot of amazing programming. Local news about Northwest Indiana that you won't find anywhere else. The highest quality of trustworthy news through NPR's seasoned national and international reporters, and countless hours of quality music and entertainment. The one thing you don't hear on Lakeshore Public Radio is advertising. This station is a community-licensed nonprofit, meaning no advertisers, no shareholders, and no financial backers, such as a university. While this can be a good thing in that it means we can remain independent, it also means that we absolutely must be able to count on our local base of listeners to pitch in with financial support. While the station has made great strides to reach a level of support that is sustainable, we have yet to meet this mark. If you've been listening for some time but have yet to donate, or perhaps you've been considering increasing your support, please do so now at lakeshorepublicradio.org. Your contribution really is the lifeblood of public radio, and the station can't serve the region without you leading the way. Thank you.
We're back here on Regionally Speaking's Reporter Roundtable Thursday with Bill Dolan of the Times of Northwest Indiana, talking first here about the trial of John Buntzich. And in turn, the jury comes back with convictions on all of the charges against the now former sheriff. What was the courtroom like, Bill, when the jury came back in? What do, I guess you always see on television and the movies about the jury of eight people, we'll say. We won't say men because we know all the old movies had men only. But the idea being that the jury files back in and then somehow or another states to the judge that we've reached a verdict.
Hey, it's all pretty deadpan these days. In fact, the judge gave a little warning to the audience, which is pretty standard. No emotion, no shouting, none of that. And there was none. I did see some supporters of the sheriff hold their head in their hands. They were pretty upset, obviously. No reaction from the sheriff. Or his attorneys, one of his attorneys seemed downcast. But pretty calm, slightly unlike Hollywood. And, of course, there was a long pause between that announcement and actually getting out of the court because the judge wanted to thank the jury for their service.
Mm-hmm. In the aftermath of that, as like you mentioned, the reaction was rather muted. Of course, at the judge's remand, so you just want no drama, as you say, basically, in the courtroom as a result of the jury verdict being announced. In the aftermath now of this, you've had some stories and good follow-up pieces in particular in this past weekend's newspaper talking about the lessons that should be learned. And we've talked before. In fact, we were even talking before we began our conversation today about the fact that it's almost like an exercise in futility, it seems, or at least history shows it that way.
Well, my editors asked me to recap the trial, and I wanted to go over some of the salient points of the government's case and that they proved. And number one, if you're going to be a politician, taking large sums of cash is probably a bad idea. The testimony in the trial was essentially politicians generally take checks, or it's strictly political, one or two political fundraising tickets, not a lot of cash. But of course, the government witnesses gave the sheriff more than $20,000 in $100 bills. You would have thought that would have been a danger sign to somebody. I don't normally get money like that, but the sheriff took the money, and now of course he rues the day. There were other things too, like he all elected officials have to report the money that goes in and goes out of their campaigns through the county election board. The government made a lot of the fact that the sheriff didn't record all of the money that he received from in these transactions, and that he sometimes his accountant or he, depending on who you believe, recorded the money as anonymous cash donations. Mr. Benson said that is completely opposite of the spirit of the law that requires candidates to report who gives them money and how much, and made quite a point of that. So you've got that. That's something you probably should be very specific about if you're going to be a candidate, who's giving you money and how much it is. And I guess the last point is don't promise things. Or be careful what you promise. Again, as I said before, the FBI agent said, "Don't promise official acts in return for bribes or campaign contributions." And of course, the sheriff also promised, as a candidate, through the Shared Ethics Advisory Board, that he would be transparent and would follow the law. And as Mr. Benson, the assistant U.S. attorney, said, he did the exact opposite.
I'm sure that there have been a number of people and organizations that are very disappointed in the outcome of the trial and in the fact that Sheriff John Buntzich is no longer the sheriff, and now once the sentencing takes place, he'll be probably doing something else for someplace else for a long time, or certainly a certain period of time, I would imagine. You mentioned about the Shared Ethics Advisory Committee and the pledge that they have all candidates take when not everybody's signed, apparently, but the idea is that most of them have, that they'll follow the law, they'll follow the rules of ethics in their office and basically toe the line, and probably said in some cases, I'm sure the Shared Ethics Advisory Committee people are not very happy about the outcome here.
Well,
doesn't make them look very good, to be
well,
sure.
Well, I don't know. I think it really it made what they did a lot more significant and important. I think a lot of these elected officials signed that ethics pledge and forgot about it. They figured this is just something that'll look good on the campaign trail. Now they know that whatever they have signed, Mr. Benson will have a copy of somewhere down the line, and if they get charged, that's going to be pushed right into their face. And how will they answer the jury when they promise to follow the law and the evidence shows otherwise? So, no, I think actually the Shared Ethics Commission should be probably quite proud of what little role they played in this case. And as for Mr. Buntzich, he will be sentenced on December the 6th. We won't know what his sentence is until that day, but it's likely to be a substantial sentence, although he has obviously no criminal record before. He was in a position of public trust that will likely weigh against him very heavily.
I know that the editorial board of the Times has already stated so and has put so in print, as well as the story on the editorial rather online, about the fact that they will be watching closely what reaction that the residents of Lake County friends and otherwise of John Buntzich will have to say as recommendations to the judge for sentencing. And it all goes back to that number of recommendations that were made in the case when the last person who's come into trial and had this kind of involvement before with a case. We're talking, of course, about the former surveyor Fantil. And a number of people spoke out in favor of him, prominent people, I understand, and remembering those notes that came into the judge's office at the time. But the Times is going to be watching to see who says what this time around.
Yes, it's kind of standard operating procedure that when a pillar of the community falls and is facing sentencing, he gets testimonials from a lot of other elected officials figures in the community. That was the case with George Fantil, mm-hmm. and undoubtedly people will be writing letters of support for the sheriff at some point. I guess the point of the editorial was it's pretty hard to say that you don't condone the crime if in fact you are supporting the man who was convicted of the crime. You can make arguments on either side of that question, and undoubtedly people will write letters to him regardless. But it does look pretty bad when somebody is sticking up for a guy who's about to go off to prison.
Mm-hmm. Now, we have a sheriff that is now no longer in office. We have the number two person kind of holding the spot now, keeping the department running in the meantime, and now we have a caucus coming up here in September to choose someone to fill the position, at least for the rest of the term of office that John Buntzich would have served. Tell us how the process is going on with that.
Yes, as we speak, Police Chief Matt Eaton, the number two in the new number two in the sheriff's department, mm-hmm. Acts as the sheriff, runs the department until a new sheriff is named. And in Indiana, when an elected official has to vacate for this reason or other reasons, the political party gets to name their replacement for the remainder of their term. So a caucus of Democratic precinct committeemen from around the county, we're talking about 523, will assemble 10 a.m. September the 16th. And several people have already announced that they will be running to replace. And the committeemen will probably hear a series of very short speeches and then cast their vote. And whoever gets the most votes from this caucus will be the sheriff from that day until the end of 2018. But, of course, they can also run for the popular election, which is next year.
Mm-hmm. I know that in talking with Lake County Democratic Party Chairman Jim Weezer, that I asked if, you know, if it's going to be a very long day for that caucus that particular Saturday, and he said, well, he expects that probably there'll be a number of ballots that'll be cast, and he was hoping not too many.
Well, there'll be a number of candidates. Yeah. We know of four already. One gentleman, Tom O'Donnell, a Highland attorney, former county councilman, told the Times yesterday that he has decided not to run. But Oscar Martinez, who's a sergeant with the county police, Rich Ligon, a federal investigator for many years, now retired out of Gary, who ran for sheriff in 2014, in 2010, will be running. I'll think of a few others here in a moment.
I think I recall that Roy Dominguez, a former sheriff, was too.
Roy has made some noises. Yeah. He's not sure. He says he doesn't know if running before a caucus is the best venue for him. He's uncertain. David Dowling, a Schererville police chief, has said that he will be running. And Dan Merchak, who's the number three in the sheriff's department, has said that he, too, will be running for the caucus in September.
So there will be more people definitely interested in at least coming in to fill the seat. And then, as you say, they'll be looking to their own campaigns into 2018 to try to get the popular vote to come out of all of this, too. So it's certainly an interesting way to round out a career, certainly a sad way in the case of John Buntzich to round out a career.
Yes, he started as a policeman in late 1971, and, of course, it's all over now.
We've been talking with Bill Dolan, who covers county government for the Times of Northwest Indiana and was sitting in during all the proceedings of the trial involving now former Sheriff John Buncich. And we'll see what happens with the other cases as other defendants have pleaded guilty. And they'll be into federal court to face their fate as well, too. And I know that, although on a separate note, that we have another trial that will happen next year involving Portage Mayor to see what happens on the federal charges that were announced on the same day as the ones against John Buncich. It's all come about here. Bill, thanks for spending some time with us here on Reporters Roundtable Thursday to talk about the work you did, stellar work, and we're all appreciative of that. And certainly it's nice to know that your work will not only live on in newsprint, but also electronically. It's be filed in some cache in some computer somewhere forever now.
Well, thank you for having me.
This is Regionally Speaking's Reporter Roundtable Thursday here on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte, and with us now is following up on the Indiana Business Report. Let's take a look at the Northwest Indiana Business Report. And to that, we turn to Joseph Pete with the Times of Northwest Indiana. And he's no doubt sitting at his desk in the newsroom in Munster, aren't you, today?
Oh, yes. Glad to be here.
A lot of things to talk about. Let's get to it here. We've talked in the past year about Hoist Liftback coming into East Chicago. It's attracted workers, and now I understand they're hiring even more.
Yes. Hoist Lift Truck, they've promised to hire about 50 or 500 workers by 2022. They build industrial forklifts for all over the world. They have a big private label deal with Toyota where they make them for the Toyota brand. And recently they announced that they're going to need like 50 more employees up to 50 more employees, 30 in the immediate future, because they're going to start building a new terminal tractor there next year. It's a new series they unveiled earlier this year. They're going to do an electric version of it and a standard like diesel engine version, and they needed an entirely separate production line to do it, so they're needing to hire some assembly workers. It's been a kind of a bright economic spot for East Chicago there. It's a growing manufacturer that's adding to the employment base there.
That's certainly got to be good news for a rather beleaguered city with Mayor Anthony Copeland. I remember he was one of the people that was the most happy to see the company come into town, and probably he gets the word about these changes like this from the company directly, and he's probably a very pleased person right now at City Hall.
Oh, absolutely. It's been a rough past couple years for East Chicago with the lead crisis and everything else. They've been shrinking the Indiana Harbor steel mills. ArcelorMittal did its so-called like footprint reorganization where they shut down many finishing lines. But this is a company that came over from the Illinois suburbs. It was drawn to Indiana because of low taxes, lower cost of doing business, lower workman's comp, that type of thing. They said they expect to save millions per year in operating costs by coming here. And they've also been like kind of an evangelist for help trying to bring over more Illinois companies to Indiana, kind of touting, hey, it's right outside third biggest city in the country, and they have all these cost advantages.
One of the other stories that you covered in the Times here the past week that we want to highlight today is talking about the fact that region businesses get mentioned on a very long list that's been published by Inc. magazine, and they've gotten on this list of 5,000 fastest growing businesses. And tell us about the ones from the region that made the list this year.
Yes. They had it looks at some of the companies that are fastest growing. There are basically two from the region, but there's also Ben's Pretzels, which, while based in Goshen, they have an extensive presence here. They are they're at the steel yard in Gary. They're in a lot of the different Myers and other big box stores. The two companies from here that were really recognized was Prime Real Estate in Crown Point. They've had some pretty huge growth, 382% over the last 3 years. It's a company that's trying to provide like a supportive and motivating environment for its real estate agents. They've seen tremendous growth. Then we did a more in-depth profile on Peepers by Peeper Specs, which is a fourth-generation family-owned business in Michigan City that designs and produces reading glasses and as well as sunglasses, and they're starting to get more into computer glasses and that type of thing to reduce eye strain. They have had tremendous growth. A lot of the companies on this list are kind of fueled by venture capital, but they're one that's been growing like more organically. They've grown 162% over the the last 3 years, they benefited greatly because they managed to get like endorsements from Oprah, Sheryl Crow plugged them in addition, like a Mom's Gifts Guide in People magazine. They've been managing to get a lot of like national attention. They have some very stylish reading glasses that they're selling through a variety of channels. And they're continuing to look at growth. They're trying to get into upscale gourmet grocers like Whole Foods. They recently inked a deal with a pharmacy chain, the largest independent pharmacy distributor nationally, to distribute that through there. But they're selling almost 40% of their business now is like in an Amazon model where it's just direct to the customers online through their website.
I was going to mention, too, that there's one other magazine, another trade magazine as well, that talks about top businesses in their particular field. And People's Bank here in Northwest Indiana gets mentioned as one of the top 200 banks. Tell us how that shaped up and why People's Bank seemed to be named.
Oh, yes. That list wouldn't include all region banks because it was from American Banker magazine, and it was looking explicitly at, they do a bunch of annual awards and rankings, and this one was looking at banks with fewer than $2 billion in assets that are publicly traded. So if you're wondering why, like, Centier or Horizon was left out, they both have well over $2 billion in assets, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
But it was based entirely on the return on investment, and People's has been putting up some good numbers in recent years. So they were ranked highly because of their ROI over the past 3 years, I believe. And they're one of only about a dozen banks in Indiana that made the cut for the top 200 community banks.
Yeah, I remember the last time we talked along these lines that we mentioned about some of the other region banks, and in particular how well many of them did up against the big boys like Chase, and how banks like Centier had done real well in another recent survey about the banks as well. We're talking with Joseph Pete, who's the business reporter for the Times of Northwest Indiana, here on Regionally Speaking today. And we'd be remiss if we didn't talk about steel, because, of course, the steel is what was the legacy of Northwest Indiana. It still keeps things going, although not to the extent as it used to. But the latest report, Joseph, that you had out here was about the latest national steel production. And what do the figures show?
Yes, the imports this year are still capturing the imports are actually up 22% this year. There's been this whole expectation all year long. The new administration has come in and said, oh, you know, they've talked a lot about the steel workers. They're going to do something for the steel workers. And they opened like a 232, Section 232 investigation, where the expectation was there'd be additional tariffs or there'd be quotas limiting the amount of foreign steel. But it was brought up that, you know, foreign steel is harmful and so forth. And so far, like nothing has basically happened. They announced that they were going to delay the, you know, tariffs and so forth that they were looking at. Steel prices have been up all year because of the expectation that these tariffs are going to happen. The market has been rebounding nicely. It's been, you know, very profitable year so far for ArcelorMittal and U.S. Steel, except for U.S. Steel's first quarter. But the problem is that, you know, there was all this opposition from some of the industry groups that generally support free markets, like the U.S. Chamber. They were putting a lot of pressure on the administration. They decided to hold off on any tariffs. And in the meantime, imports have increased by more than 22%. They're capturing around a near record 29% of the market share. These are kind of the same conditions we saw in the early 2000s when all those mills went out of business. A lot of the companies were just disappeared from the lakeshore. And then from 2015, when we had thousands of layoffs at the local mills, East Chicago Tin was briefly idled. We had all those problems. The conditions still haven't materially improved much with imports, and now steel executives are starting to get impatient. They're starting to send letters, including from John Brett from ArcelorMittal USA and David Burritt from U.S. Steel. The CEOs signed a letter encouraging the administration to, you know, put some of its America First policies into effect and take some action on the influx of foreign steel that's been harming our mills and costing us jobs.
Now, Joseph, to kind of wrap things up here for this time around, I know that you cover a lot of very serious topics that happen here in Northwest Indiana, but every once in a while you get what some people would call a softball tossed at you here, but it really isn't. I mean, we know Chicago is home to a lot of film companies. Production is for films and television shows are done in Chicago almost every day, it seems like. And finally, we get some filming that's happening in a Northwest Indiana business. Tell us about Napoleon Dynamite.
Yes. The Napoleon Dynamite star John Hader has been in the Lan Oaks Lanes in Lansing, not far from our office here in Munster, filming an independent movie when Jester tried to save the world. It also stars Jim O'Hare, who was on, best known as Jerry on Parks and Rec, and he actually is a Thornton Fractional graduate from Lansing who actually bowled in that bowling alley when he was a kid.
Oh.
And it's now I believe he's playing the evil corporate executive who's trying to like redevelop it and take it over, and the John Hader, Napoleon Dynamite, plays Jeff, who's trying to save it. It's the only place he's ever known. It's a very talented Munster native who recently graduated from Chapman University near LA, Kendall Goldberg. She's made several short films, including ones that have been nominated for like the Student Academy Awards and so forth. She shot a similar short version there last year as like a proof of concept that she took around to different film festivals and managed to secure funding through that route, and now she's able to make it into like a full-length motion picture. They've been doing an 18-day shoot in Chicago. Most of it's there in Lansing. They also shot at a hospital in the west suburbs and at an apartment somewhere in like Logan Square or one of those neighborhoods. And then they're looking, once they complete the filming, they're looking to start shipping it around at some of the Sundance and some of the other film festivals and try to get it distribution. I'm not an expert on Hollywood, but it does have like, you know, some pretty big names in the cast.
Yeah.
So I could see it, you know, coming soon to movie theaters.
Well, we know that producers look for the best places that will suit them well, if, you know, will be the right atmosphere for whatever the script happens to say, and follow through with that as well, too. I know it doesn't necessarily mean that we're going to find more films that are shot in Northwest Indiana, but it's got to be very good to get a mention like this a time or two. We know that the city of Gary has their little office of film and television set up over there to handle all of these producers' requests that have come in for a lot of the landmarks in the city of Gary. So I'm supposed it'd be an idea for somebody to maybe set something up on a countywide basis to look for for spots for next film that some producer's working on.
We've had a few over the years. We had Public Enemies in downtown Crown Point with Johnny Depp. There was Transformers and Freddy Krueger movies in Gary. Sense8, the Wachowski sisters had done in downtown Gary. They filmed an episode there in the City Methodist Church. Pearl Harbor shot there. There have been we actually did a slideshow this week highlighting some of the films that have historically been shot in the Appointment with Danger with Alan Ladd had been shot at Union Station in Gary. There was the funniest one we came across was Bloodbath in Psychotown, which was shot in Chesterton in the 80s or 90s. It was one of those low-budget trauma horror films. And it just happened to be shot in Chesterton. But there has been a history of, we've got some great industrial landscapes here in Northwest Indiana, and there has been a history of, film shooting here.
Joseph Pete is a reporter for the Times of Northwest Indiana, covering the Business Bee here in Northwest Indiana. And on occasion, when it comes up here, Hollywood, or at least a side look at Hollywood as well. Joseph, thanks for spending some time with us to talk things today.
All right, thank you.
And you're listening to Regionally Speaking here on listener-supported Lakeshore Public Radio. Continuing on here on the Regionally Speaking's Reporters Roundtable Thursday, it's time to turn to John Gard, who is a reporter with the Michigan City News-Dispatch and the LaPorte Herald-Argus. John, thanks for joining us today.
Yeah, hi, Chris. Thanks for having me.
A number of stories you had in the newspapers here recently. Let's get started here talking about one that involves a rec center that's planned in that area.
Yeah, that's at Newport Landing in LaPorte, and it's the Dunes Event Center, which is a facility that was has been operating in nearby Rolling Prairie for a number of years. It's primarily a volleyball club that draws players and their parents and other fans from around the region, and the operator of that wants to build a new and much larger facility here in LaPorte that's expected to draw some economic development and give a kickstart to the downtown economy.
Now, when are they supposed to start construction on this now?
They're saying in the spring. They'll be they'll have it open by next year is what the hope is. And that's a pretty large facility. It's 50,000 square feet.
Well, what finally got things going? I guess it had been under consideration for quite some time, wasn't it?
Yes, Newport Landing has been around for a while. It's a former brownfield where Alice Chalmers formerly operated and built agricultural equipment, that had been closed for a couple of decades now, and it had been cleaned up, and the City Redevelopment Commission has been pitching that to developers for some time now, and they're just lately starting to get some hits on that, this being among them.
Well, that's interesting. It's interesting. One of the other stories that you covered as well in the newspapers, and we take a look at here, involves the Blue Chip Casino, and I guess it's a review back about 20 years or so. What's that all about?
Yeah, they're celebrating 20 years now when they opened in Michigan City on Trail Creek, and a lot has changed since then. When it opened, of course, casinos in Indiana had to actually de-boat and float out and carry customers with them, and that's all changed. And Blue Chip has changed as well. It's built a nice hotel out there, and it's really been it proved to be an economic boon for the whole region, actually. So the county commissioners last week did their part to celebrate their anniversary.
Now, how much money is the LaPorte County government and other entities in the county getting now as their share of some of the proceeds from the Blue Chip?
Yeah, they have depended on it over the years, and it's declined somewhat, and even more starting this year because there were some rules changes about how admissions are taxed and that kind of thing. So, in addition to competition from some new casinos, both in New Buffalo and in South Bend, has kind of taken a little bit of a bite out of. But the Blue Chip continues to be the second most attended casino in the state.
I understand. It's a very, very, very busy place up there, too. And speaking about these other casinos here, in fact, just yesterday I had a chance to talk with Ed Feigenbaum with Indiana Gaming Insight newsletter about the fact that the Pottawatomie Indians want to get another casino started, that one that's being proposed there in the South Bend area, and about all the problems that when the first one opened up, of course, which is now the Four Winds Casino across the state line at New Buffalo, they had a tough time there at Blue Chip to kind of fight with that.
Yeah, and you know, who knows what the upshot will be, but the competition can be healthy or not. So, but it certainly is competition for Blue Chip, which is also has proven itself to be an entertainment venue. You know, a lot of big acts come in. So it's in addition to just the casino, you know, it's proven itself to be a pretty solid corporate partner.
We're talking with John Gard with the LaPorte Herald Argus and the Michigan City News Dispatch about some of the stories that he's worked on here in the recent days. And another story here that we'd like to take a look at in more detail is, I guess, some new policies that have been set up here for student attendance. Tell us about that, please.
Yeah, the school corporation in LaPorte has adopted a new attendance policy starting this school year, which started a couple of weeks ago, and it's going to emphasize personal responsibility from the kids, in addition to what is sometimes referred to as seat time. So you've got to, the centerpiece of the thing is that if you have absences or tardies, that those will count against your grade. And so that it gives kids some incentive to be on time and be in class.
Well, it's interesting to hear about that. And also another story that you worked on from the LaPorte Community Schools talks about an intermediate school that is being proposed. What's the latest on that?
Right. Yeah, that's a big project. That's going to be a $40 million project, and they're building a facility that will be incorporated with one of the middle schools here in town, and all of the fifth, sixth, seventh, and eighth graders will all attend this new intermediate school, and they are currently planning to put that out to bid in October.
Now, I understand that's not going to be the only new construction of a school that's being planned there in LaPorte. There's another one. I guess it's underway right now, right?
Yes, a new elementary school. One of the new elementary schools is being rebuilt on the same site as the old elementary school. So the kids there, they lost their playground temporarily, and they're and they're having a recess out in a section of the parking lot. But it's going to new facility that will allow preschool there. It'll give them some extra room to work, and it'll be a nice facility. And then also at the high school, they're building a performing arts center, which also looks is just a big underway now. Construction on that has just started.
Now on that project, how long was that one in the works? And I guess it was going to meet a big demand in LaPorte, won't it?
Yeah, and LaPorte's big into its arts and music, and so it's seen as something that'll really get a lot of use. And of course, the high school has outgrown its auditorium, so this will be a nice facility for the kids for sure, and for the community generally. But all three of those projects are part of about $80 million worth of projects to realign the programming and to provide new facilities.
Now, finally, John, we understand that they had a story that talks about the new mayor of LaPorte and his new leadership team, at least new to him, certainly, to be sure. How did the new mayor do in his first weeks on the job in City Hall?
Well, he seems to be doing just fine. He was part of the former mayor's administration, so he knew his way around and was on the Board of Works and the Redevelopment Commission, and so he is seen as a somebody who's continuing the previous administration of Blair Milo. But Mark Krentz is he's had a long history with the city, and in fact, his father was mayor 20 years ago.
So. Oh, really?
Yeah. He's since been in business and been involved in government, and so he knows his way around pretty well.
Now, is his father still around? Certainly around to see his son become mayor?
No, I'm afraid not. No, he passed a few years ago, but the legacy is still alive, and you can tell Mark's he's quite proud of it, and I think he's really excited to be mayor.
John Gard is reporter for the Herald Argus in LaPorte, as well as the Michigan City News Dispatch, and we check in with him on occasion to find out about big stories over in LaPorte County. And John, as always, thank you very much for being with us today.
Yeah, thank you, Chris.
And a new development from Lake County today, the John Dillinger Museum, which is located in the lower level of the historic old courthouse in downtown Crown Point, is now closed. It's a very sudden announcement, certainly, that came out this morning in a news release from the South Shore Convention and Visitors Authority. Museum opened up in Crown Point after being relocated from the Indiana Visitor Center over in Hammond in the summer of 2015. Now, the CVA spokesperson I talked to, Erica Dahl, said that this decision to permanently close the John Dillinger Museum was not a hasty one. It was made after considerable review and discussion. But she did not say, and the news release does not say, why the museum was closing. But Erica did apologize to everybody who had made plans to visit the museum for the inconvenience. Since the museum opened up in Crown Point, it has welcomed approximately 20,000 people from around the world. And besides the historical artifacts of the museum from the John Dillinger era, also there was a special memorial that was inside the museum to honor local law enforcement officers who had given their lives in the line of duty. Crown Point Mayor David Uran is sad to learn of the John Dillinger Museum's closing. He said it was an asset to the city's downtown, not only economically, but he says it told the story of a local law enforcement, the FBI, and the story that ultimately crime doesn't pay. And in talking with Erica Dahl, she says that all the options are being explored for the John Dillinger Museum, including finding perhaps another location for the exhibits. And that's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you very much for being with us. And our thanks always to Bill Dolan and to Joseph Pete with the Times of Northwest Indiana for their stories that we've had on Reporters Roundtable Thursday, and also John Gard with the News Dispatch and the Herald Argus as well. Thank you for being with us today. And coming up after the holiday on Monday, on Tuesday's program, we'll find out more about a report concerning the impact of lead contamination health risks and some recommendations the report makes for action. That's coming up on Tuesday's Regionally Speaking.